quick and.
And then he starts crying. Yeah, and yeah, my mom. And he was so funny because he put his belt on and he starts walking like a guy.
Okay, I think we're ready to get this party started. We're going to start with the Pledge of Allegiance, and I'll begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Someday. Soon. Okay, everybody's had a chance to look at the minutes. Do we have any recommendations, any changes? You want to approve them as read?
We need the roll call, Chair.
The roll call first.
We can do minutes first.
Thank you.
Go ahead, you can do the roll call.
Commissioner DeGrasse.
Present.
Commissioner Hurd.
Present.
Commissioner Hartwig.
Present.
Commissioner Main.
Present.
Commissioner Pitts.
Present.
Commissioner Castillo. And Commissioner Montgomery.
Present.
Thank you.
Okay. Now everybody's had a chance to review the minutes with that little intermission. Do we have a recommendation? I got a question. I notice you have down here commissioners present. You got the vice chair, but you don't have the title for the chair. What's up with that? I knew you would.
I'll move the minutes with the correction from Chair Main.
Thank you.
And I'll second the motion.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Any abstentions? Good, it's carried. Moving right along. Any modifications to the agenda? Hearing none, I'd like to make one. I think we should take and put item G first on the agenda, so that when we start talking about item A, we can put something in context. Okay. Item G being, you know, the Supreme Court decision regarding redevelopment agency and the money and all that good stuff. Since we're talking about some of our project-based vouchers and money, I wanted to find out how that plays into what we are going to find out from the discussion. Any objections? Hearing none? That'll be the order. Any reports from legal counsel?
No, no, commissioners. There were no final decisions in the last closed session.
Okay. I think we're about to have a report from legal counsel with item G, using that first on the agenda.
Good evening, commissioners. This item we put on the agenda because there's been so much movement in the redevelopment, and I thought it was worthwhile to agendize it so we could have some conversations and also get a report from our legal counsel in terms of some of the activities related to redevelopment and as they affect both us and Oakland. So I want to turn it over to Jennifer Bell to give a brief report.
I knew you would.
Okay, am I on? Yes. Okay.
Yes.
I'll just give a summary of what happened in the Supreme Court. I'm sure many of you know about the Matto Santos case that was decided at the end of December by the Supreme Court. There were two bills last year in the state assembly, and one was to kill redevelopment agencies, and the second bill was to sort of reestablish them by an opt-in process where agencies could opt in to continue to participate as redevelopment agencies by making a payment to the state and agreeing to make continued payments in the future. Unfortunately, the California Redevelopment Association, which is an association of a lot of redevelopment agencies across the state, sued to declare these bills unconstitutional. And the unfortunate part was the Supreme Court declared the 126, which was the killing, elimination of redevelopment agencies, constitutional, but the reconstituted redevelopment agency bill unconstitutional, which was actually unfortunately connected to Proposition 22, which was passed the fall of 2010, which was an attempt by local governments to make sure that the state didn't take money away from it. So as a result, redevelopment agencies effective February 1st, are no longer in existence in California. And what they were supposed to do is put continuing obligations on a list of on a list called the EOPS, enforceable obligations, yep. payment schedule, and then no other activities by the redevelopment agencies that weren't already authorized prior to the decision could be taken. Money is there's money in the Affordable Housing Fund. That's something that's probably most affects the housing authorities. Under redevelopment, 20% of the money that went to redevelopment agencies every year was supposed to go into a low and moderate income housing fund, and that money was supposed to be used for the development of low and moderate income housing. That money is not supposed to go to the what are called the successor housing agencies, which would be the city in the case of Oakland. There is a bill pending that was supposed to be heard today, but was not heard today, AB 645, which would have transferred any balances in the affordable housing funds to the cities to comply with these enforceable obligations. You know, there's a lot going on in the legislature right now, and I think I'm hopeful that there's actually going to be a plan to recreate something like redevelopment, but without going into the details of whatever each city has to do and what each successor agency has to do, I think what it is actually doing is going to mean for the Oakland Housing Authority, that the Housing Authority may be more involved in housing development because that's part of your mission, and you may be ending up committing more OHA funds if they're available to projects in order to continue your mission, because the city, as you know, had relied so much on redevelopment agency money that people are being laid off. It may, if the 645 passes, get the balance of the money, but that would only go to projects that have already been approved, some of which, you know, are connected with the Housing Authority. So if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions? Oh, Ms. Montgomery.
Yeah, okay, so the projects that are already being developed under redevelopment funds can continue. Will there be money left in there to continue those?
Yes, each agency was supposed to create an enforceable obligations payment schedule and to list everything that they'd already committed, even money that had not been spent yet, but, you know, money that had been committed. And talking to the city attorney's office in Oakland, they have definitely included everything, and maybe a few extra things. So I think in terms of projects in Oakland with redevelopment money, anything that is committed is actually on that EOPS list.
We'll go right down the line. Mr. Hartwig.
Yes. Have we done an assessment of what impact the lack of redevelopment funds might have on the risk of projects that we've already embarked on? And if we have, we don't need to know what that is right now. I just want to know if we've done that and if we have, and if there is any exposure, can we get a rundown on that at some point?
And I think that we'll have to come back to you in the next month or two with it, because it's been moving. What we do know is we believe that the Cathedral project has an enforceable obligation on it and will proceed, and that's very good news. What we believe is that we don't have any other we have two applications in for Lion Creek Crossing and for Lakeside Senior, in which we're in both deals for city funds. Those are both senior developments, and so redevelopment funds I don't think were part of could be used for the senior fund, so they're using another pot. We don't know how much money they're going to have to award yet. So as the spring kind of moves on, we'll have a better idea of those two projects. And we're looking with Bridge at any other possibility for 460 grand, which would be the other one that may have to be completely restructured. And so those conversations are ongoing. And I think what we'll do is once we get a better handle on what the city will award this year, we'll know how to come back and how to give you an update of the lists, each one of the deals like we did prior when we were looking at project-based. Yeah. The other thing I wanted to say is this could put some additional pressure on project-based Section 8 in the long term, but it also could delay or even derail some of the awards this board has already made. So we may have made awards into deals that may now not go forward if they can't secure the money.
You mean project-based?
Project-based Section 8,
right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which kind of puts it in context of what the chair was saying with the next project-based award. When we lost the 202 money for the Lakeside project, then some of the affordability would have been changed if we don't 100% project-based that portfolio. You'd already awarded 30-some-odd vouchers to the project. By doing 100%, we make sure that we make it affordable in that neighborhood for the seniors, and that's good. It allows the partnership to go back and get a loan into the project for that, and that's good. The last thing that I just want to kind of throw out in terms of project basing is we spent a lot of time in December's meeting talking about our strategies and how far we want to go. When we were projecting out subsequent years on the number of vouchers, this may dramatically reduce the number of units that are generated in Oakland that we could use project-based Section 8 in. And it also will mean that we will probably have to issue our own NOFAs to award or RFPs to award project-based Section 8 going forward. We won't be able to just use the city's process. And that's not only time-consuming, it's burdensome for our partners, it's burdensome for everybody, but I think that's going to be the way we're going to have to go about issuing vouchers in the future as well.
Okay. Ms. Hurd.
I have some questions on the timeline.
Okay, let me pull it out.
And the timeline provided, by the way, was created not by us. It was
right.
Right.
Yeah. Could I still ask my questions?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Okay. I just wanted everyone to know it wasn't us who came up with the timeline.
Well, except let me preface your before you go ahead with your question. This is related to SB 659.
Right.
And 659 is the bill that would extend the dissolution from February 1st to May 1st. And everybody thinks it's doubtful that it's going to be passed. Mm-hmm. And I think the governor has also said that he would veto it if it did pass.
Okay.
So people kind of think this one is dead in the water. It's
okay.
645 that would transfer the money from the Affordable Housing Fund to the successor housing agencies that hopefully will pass.
Okay. So my question deals with the oversight boards,
mm-hmm.
and how does that process take place?
Okay. There, I don't know the details of the oversight boards, but I just can't remember off the top of my head. But the oversight boards are actually for money for primarily non-housing projects, because the city becomes both the successor agency and what we've called, even though the legislation doesn't call it that, the successor housing agency. So sometimes the city puts on the housing agency hat and sometimes it puts on the successor agency hat. You know, kind of like it when the housing authority, when the city council met as the city council, then it would adjourn and it would meet as the redevelopment agency. The oversight board is supposed to review everything that the successor agency does, and actually can cancel contracts.
Okay.
But it's unlikely, we think, that it will cancel housing contracts because first of all, it's only money that hasn't been spent under enforceable obligations that it could possibly cancel, and if they're in deals that have other financing, it's unlikely that it'll be canceled.
Okay.
I'm not totally familiar with all the different projects that may be in the pipeline for commercial projects in the city, but sometimes putting a package together of housing loans, you're talking about tax credits, you're talking about AHP, you're talking about home, you're talking about CDBG, you sort of know what the financing is going to be. But a commercial project could have anything, and the city could have made a commitment to put some money into something. with the hopes that the developer would get other financing, not knowing what it would be.
Okay.
And the oversight board could say, that's too much of a risk. Forget it. You're not doing it. You're canceling that contract. And we'd rather pay the damages.
Okay.
I want to just interject a little bit about the oversight board, because I've had conversations with your colleague, David Crute, on what it's made up and what it is. The oversight boards are established by each community redevelopment agency in the county of Alameda, and there are several. They have appointments that are from the mayor. They have one person from the Redevelopment Association sit on the board, and those would be the two cities. They have two appointments from the county. They have appointments from, I think it's the Mosquito Abatement District, if I'm not wrong, and from
College.
And the Community College.
College, yeah.
So that makes up the board, and I really appreciate your question, because they're going to, that board is going to oversee not really the housing end,
yes,
but the rest of the redevelopment assets.
Exactly.
And I think having someone and who's on that board is actually really important initially for us, if there's opportunities for us to do anything with those assets that are beneficial. In 2016, those boards then become one board.
Mm-hmm.
And what David thought was that there would definitely have to be clarifying legislation, because if you have six mayors trying to appoint six seats and there's only one seat, and how that's all going to work is something that is going to have to be clarified. But at least initially, who's on those boards, the makeup in the decision is one from the mayor, one from the community redevelopment, the local community redevelopment, two from the county, and then the two other taxing agencies. So I think we're going to keep a real strong eye on that. I think it's really valuable to have people understand housing opportunities and development opportunities.
And hopefully before 2016, there'll be a new program.
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah.
That's it? Okay. Mr. Negrange.
Well, just to reiterate Greg's point earlier about in order to assess the financial risk to us, it would be helpful to see a list of pending projects, and I think the discreet worry is the expectation of a redevelopment source coming in, and if we think it's not going to come in, is there a pre-development loan that's going to come due, and when that term comes due, what happens if we actually don't have all the sources of financing? Mm-hmm. So just to confirm that for the outstanding projects, especially those that we think are going to be heavily impacted, mm-hmm. There is not going to be significant financial risk in like a year or two when a pre-dev loan comes due. So if there could be some way for us to assess that
next time. And just for record, I think it's probably we'll probably have to assess it in a closed session, because it's negotiations for real estate and the contracts, yeah. Right.
Okay. Any more questions? Comments? Second round? Hearing none. Do we have a motion? Oh, no. We just need to accept that. That's just the report.
We have to accept reality.
Yeah, exactly.
Should we reject reality?
Yeah, right.
No, that's
reality?
Not a...
No, we do not.
We don't do that here. Okay, item A, a resolution that we have to consider.
Item A is a consideration of a resolution authorizing the executive director to award 59 additional project-based Section 8 vouchers to the Lakeside Senior Affordable Housing Development, a project of Satellite Housing Incorporated, and the Oakland Housing Initiatives Incorporated in partnership with the Oakland Housing Authority. This is an effort to replace and make it more lucrative on having lost that not been funded for the 202 program this year, and help fill some of the gaps. I'm not certain if Phil Neville wants to add anything to the report, but it's really us trying to preserve affordability in the neighborhood and make sure this project can move forward. And that concludes our report, I hear, and I'm available for any questions.
Especially in light of what we just mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. With the redevelopment money disappearing. Mr. Negrange, I see your hand up. Or that's a finger.
Five fingers.
It was the right finger, no problem.
So either Eric or Phil, for the HUD 202, the request is that the project-based vouchers would replace the HUD 202 vouchers.
And they won't fill the whole gap.
And was there a capital request for the HUD 202? And if so, what would be the replacement for the capital request that was not accepted by HUD?
I will call Mr. Neville up to ask that. I'm not sure.
The general answer to Commissioner Nagraj's question is that yes, the 202 did carry something called a PRAC, and there was a capital amount of that, and these vouchers will not fill that gap between what we would have gotten from HUD and what we can borrow with the Section 8 vouchers. It's a step in the right direction. I would bring up, if you'd like to get into the detail of that, both Dory Kojima and Cindy Havens are here tonight from Satellite, our partner. They're sitting with Bridget Galka. And would you like to get in a little more detail?
No more detail than what you think is appropriate, but okay. If there is a gap, is there a plan to fill the gap?
Yeah, that's what I'm
about. Well, the general plan for the gap, to fill the gap, is to keep moving forward. Once we find out if the board will allocate the vouchers tonight, where we'll have project-based vouchers for all but one unit, the manager's unit, we'll be working with the lenders to see what we can borrow against that. And we just in the back of an envelope, we know that's not going to give us the same amount we would have had, but it may put us in position to go for 9% credits. Why don't we get Satellite up here just to expand on that a little bit? Dory,
if we can have your name and title.
Sure.
For the record.
Good evening, commissioners. My name is Dory Kojima with Satellite Housing. So just to answer your question, you know, the project-based Section 8 vouchers, we will use that to leverage additional permanent debt. We do have the MHP supportive housing commitment for 4.7, which we intend to use. The rest of the gap that was created by not receiving the HUD 202 award, we anticipate, as Eric's mentioned, restructuring the project so that we could potentially apply for tax credit financing to make up for the remainder of that gap. And all of that we are still working out, along with the City of Oakland's NOFA is in process and is kind of has been affected by the redevelopment agency decision, as you know. So we are also in contact with the City of Oakland regarding the pending NOFA award request as well. So until those moving parts are kind of further defined, you know, we are applying for these Section 8 vouchers to help us move this project forward towards that, and then we'll know more once we know more about what the City of Oakland is going to do. And if that answers your question.
Is your hand up? Okay. Ms. Hurd.
And it might be for her, too. This is a question regarding the 202 funding. It says that the development team learned that the likelihood of another round of HUD 202 funding becoming available now.
I'm sorry?
The HUD 202 funding?
So what we currently understand for the HUD 202 program in this fiscal year is that HUD is not funding funds for new units for HUD 202. So we're unsure as to what will happen next year, but currently this funding NOFA that typically comes out annually is not funding any new units.
Okay.
So there's additional to the RDA issue, there's obviously things going on at the federal level that is also making it much more difficult to serve the low-income seniors that we are targeting.
Okay.
And sometimes when HUD has a small amount of money in the budget, so if Congress and I have to check appropriations, had a small amount of money, they won't go through a RENOFA process. They'll look at previous applications and fund more from the previous cycle.
Okay.
And that we just have to determine. And then I think we'll know for sure sometime in the next 4 months.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Thank you.
Done, Ms. Hurd?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good.
Thank you.
Mr. Hartwig.
Yes. If we award the 97 vouchers, and let's say that the project is significantly delayed due to financing problems or whatever, is that award going to reduce the number of vouchers that we can have outstanding in the interim? Perhaps you could just explain how that works. I just want to...
No, that's a great question, because people think once we make the award at these meetings that we're holding those and nobody gets to touch them.
Right.
That is not how we do it. We actually have...
Right.
We lease these up, and these are in use in the tenant-based program. And then when they're getting close to finishing construction on it, that's when we look at our lists and the attrition and we start planning. So these don't pull vouchers from anyone until they're ready to be used on that property.
That's what I thought. Thank you. Just wanted to make sure that my understanding was correct.
Okay. Any more comments?
I'll move the item.
It's been moved and seconded. Is that a third?
No.
Oh.
Sorry, it's another comment.
You can have another comment. Right. Okay. Yes, Mr. McGrath.
I guess I'm struggling because I feel like we've had some projects come forth with uncertainty in financing and, you know, here's a A, B, C, D of what we're going to do after. Mm-hmm. This one, I'm glad that Greg asked that question. This one seems like a request for vouchers. I hear we'll see how much debt we can leverage. I hear we may, I guess, redesign to see if we're competitive for one of the tax credit, for the tax credit application. It feels a little squishier to me than here are the two or three strategies that we're going to go after, and this is the timeline. And so I guess all that to say is that I would move to approve also, but I think it'd be more helpful, maybe even as part of the report, to, you know, hear the three sources that we think we're actually going to go after. And, you know, and I think even using placeholder, you know, loan amounts based on what you think, the you know, tranche A, tranche B, what you can leverage, would be helpful. Because I don't right now know if your gap is around 500K or around like 3 million. Right. So it's just hard to assess.
Well, certainly in losing, you know, two-thirds of our assistance, you know, in other words, we had the project-based voucher award that you gave us last year because we hope to get the 202 award for the majority of the units. And we're trying to use a little bit of code tonight where we don't want to say things. I think Eric and Dory have both done a very good job about dancing around this issue. HUD does have some home funds that they award to the City of Oakland. Those funds are being contested by two applications that we're involved with. Both teams are here tonight. One is Lion Creek 5, one is Lakeside. Lakeside is still very much in contention for maybe only a couple million dollars of home funds. We don't know if they're going to get those funds, but obviously they can't. We're not eligible for redevelopment funds anyway, even aside from the redevelopment agency being eliminated. I think I heard someone would be here from the city tonight, but I don't want to put them on the spot if they are. I don't see anybody from the city tonight, but the point being, we don't want to say any more than that in a public meeting at this time.
But I would say the point's well taken. I mean, if we're going to be instituting these awards, particularly in the future, how do we get to completion and get the awards in service is kind of the crux of what you're asking. And it could be a couple of scenarios, and I think maybe we can work on improving some of those in the packet so that we know that this is how we think we're going to get from you make an award, how are they going to get it under construction, take out the construction loan to permanent financing where we can use those vouchers.
Yeah, and the risk seems really low based on Greg's question that it's not like we're allocating and we're locking and we can. So if there's massive delays in financing, we can reallocate. So it's kind of low risk, but it also just helps our risk assessment. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay. Any other questions, discussion? Hearing none, everybody's heads is going like this. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same side? Any abstentions? It's unanimous, it's carried. Done. Item A. Item B.
Item B is a design presentation and review for the Lion Creek Crossing Phase 5, which is 128-unit senior affordable housing development. I'll call Phil Neville up to the microphone and make the introductions. And our electronic presentation.
The design presentation this evening for Lion Creek Crossings Phase 5 is going to be made by the Oakland-based firm HKIT Architects. They've done some very good work in both affordable housing and in private development. The lead designer is the gentleman passing out the copies to you. But we're going to try to do a PowerPoint presentation, which Inez has been good enough to load in for us. Rod Henme is the lead designer, and he has a colleague here tonight as well that may participate. We also have in the audience tonight both Jeremy Liu from Ebaldsi and Lydia Tan from the related companies, in addition to our staff, Steve Hoppe.
Good evening, Mr. Commissioner, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission. My name is Jeremy Liu. I'm the Executive Director of Ebaldsi. We're delighted to be here, as we have been before. on this large project, Lion Creek Crossings. Today, we are sympathetic to the concerns that you've raised, and we were in the development committee all working very diligently to come up with answers and solutions. But today, we're excited to be able to show you the design, just present to you the design of what's planned for Lion Creek Crossings 5. We're going to turn it over really to our development architect, and we'll be here to answer any questions. Thank you.
And I turned around too soon. Carlos Castellanos, Director of Development for Ybald City, is also in the audience tonight.
Good evening, commissioners, and good evening to the audience behind. My name is Rod Hedman, Director of Design for HKIT Architects, and I'm pleased to present our design for Lion Creek Crossing Phase 5. If you refer to your screens or to the drawings that we've placed in front of you, and it's convenient for the audience to see as well, the first photograph shows the photographs of the surrounding context of the previous four phases. So on the top, you can see looking essentially from the site to the surrounding affordable family housing buildings. There's also a creek, which is shown in the photograph to the lower left, that is on the north edge of the site. And finally, Axe Christian Academy, a church, occurs to the east side of the site, which is in the lower right photograph. Next, please. Looking straight across the park from the site is the, straight across from the site is a public park, which is shown on the top photo, and the lower photo shows the site itself behind the chain link fence, and on that edge is also an affordable family housing complex, which you can see there. Next, please. So this photograph, our illustration, shows the basic concept where the park, as you can see, the building site in gray, shown on the upper right, faces the park. And the building, which is to the north side of the park, is a long, essentially four-story building. And our building, by virtue of its density, also needs to be four stories. And so what we wanted to try is to complete the enclosure of that building, which occurs to the north, and sort of wrap around, which you can see with the sort of ochre-colored band, and so that it defines the park. And also you can notice that Lion Way bends at that point, and so we want to sort of address the part that before it bends, that is the 90-degree area, and so we push the building to the north in order to address that part. Next, please. So here you can see the site plan where the building is pushed to the north, so it addresses that straight part straight across from the park. The parking lot is pushed to the south. That provides a bit of breathing room between the family housing, which occurs to the south, and allows us to start to really provide that well-defined wrapping edge that creates a strong and we think very proud kind of face toward the park. In the top drawing, you can see the sort of what we're calling the context drawing. It shows the housing, family housing complex to the left, which is the existing, then our building, and then the family housing complex to the right. And so you can see that our four-story building is compatible and also very closely related in size and scale, even though it is actually one story taller than the family housing buildings. Next, please. The first story plan shown here is a courtyard building, so it wraps around a very well-defined but commodious courtyard that has outdoor patio spaces for the residents to be able to gather. The community room opens into that space, and the parking lot is located to the right or to the south. You can see it's surrounded by landscaped yard, essentially, which will also serve as a fire access drive, but it will be essentially all fully landscaped. And the entry to the building itself occurs in the lower right corner, where it has a prominent public sense, and it also provides eyes on the space in terms of the gate for the parking entry, the resident entry, which occurs behind the gate, so they can park the cars and then enter in safety. And so it occurs as a kind of hub, and we'll show that in a bit. Next, please. The upper floor plan is similar, except the community room itself is only one story high, so there's a deck on top of the community room. One of the things you can see here is that we paid a lot of attention to trying to make the corridors pleasant, light-filled, and not at all a kind of institutional feeling. So the corridors actually have, the one facing the park actually steps. It's wider at the point of, at the elevator. So we think of it something like a river, where the tributaries at the far ends are narrower, but when it starts to flow toward the point of where there are more people, that is the elevator, it actually starts to widen. You can also see that at the elevator, there is a fully light-filled area, so the corridor starts to open into the outside space. The units are one-bedroom units, with the exception of nine two-bedroom units, which are shown in the upper left, facing the courtyard area. Next, please. This drawing shows the front of the building facing the park, where, as I mentioned, our goal was to provide a proud symbol both of you, the Housing Authority, and the overall complex toward the park, where the even though it's a four-story building, we're trying to provide a great sense of scale and sort of breaking down some of those elements. So there's a top kind of cornice element, we might say, of those decks, so that the building has a well-defined base with the wall that you can see that provides some privacy for those lower ground floor units. And then it climbs up to the cap or cornice at the top. The entry is in the lower right, but you can see how there's a kind of band of wood elements that climb up the gap, and that's where the stair occurs. And then at the very top of this element, or this corner element, is an outdoor deck that provides a great view for residents to be able to come outside. We speculate they'll actually be able to see San Francisco from that point, we hope. Or at least they'll have a great view of the park, and it's a sun-filled corner. Not only does it provide an amenity for the people looking from the inside out, but also from the park and the outside in, that it becomes a kind of symbol of openness and a kind of welcoming sense, so that this building truly becomes a kind of lantern for the park and a kind of, as I say, proud symbol. Next, please. Here's a slightly angled view that shows people walking a long line way. The street does bend at that point, so this is actually a view that pedestrians and cars would start to see. They're looking right at the corner, and so you can see how important that is. The units facing the south and the west also have sun shades in order to increase the protection from the heat gain. HKIT is very concerned about sustainability, and so we have a high level of green points that we are aiming for on this project, and the building is a highly sustainable building for that reason. Next, please. Here's the other elevation. The top elevation is the elevation facing the parking, and the lower one is the drawing facing the park, which you've already seen. And next, please. And then finally, here's a view that shows the coming from the opposite direction. From the north side, you can see that the northern corner, which is quite prominent because as you drive along the street, you start to see those faces that are perpendicular to your view. And so you can see that. So we've paid attention to craft that corner and start to make it both pleasant, again, both from inside out as well as outside in. And this also shows the quality of the sidewalk treatment and the idea of a low wall that creates some privacy and yet at the same time animates that that street frontage. So with that, be happy to answer any questions.
This must be an old site, ma'am, because one of our developments is missing.
Ah, you mean the first
one of the
A2?
Phases is not there.
Yes. Yes. This was the most recent sort of Google shot. So no, it's not yet completed. Or the photograph does not show the completion of the phase four.
Yeah. Okay. Right there. We have a whole new development right there. Phase four.
Yep.
Phase four. Okay. Yeah.
That's good.
Quick. I don't see no hands.
Oh.
Okay.
It does show piles of gravel though, or something like.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. A little late.
Yeah.
And this, yeah, we finished developing that. As a matter of fact, are we occupying it? Mm-hmm. Somebody asked me that recently because that looked like it was getting.
Yes.
Occupied. Wonderful.
So. Yeah, staff did a walkthrough. I was not part of it a few days ago. An initial, just kind of walkthrough. Yeah.
Good. Good. Yeah, we need to have a new picture.
Okay.
Ms. Hurd.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for this. This is very beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me get my question. Okay, since this is going to be for 62-year-olds, it says that we will have 7 apartments for physically disabled. Hmm. 3 will be for sight and hearing, so that leaves 4 for the disabled. Mm-hmm. And I'm just thinking, we have a growing aging population. Mm-hmm. Why don't we have more for the disabled?
Hmm. The building is what's called fully adaptable. That is, 128 units can be easily converted into accessible units. Okay. So the intention is that they would be converted as needed, because as you probably know, accessible units are inconvenient for able-bodied people.
Yes.
The other thing is that our office does a lot of senior housing, so we design with the concepts of aging in place. So there are one type of unit will actually be particularly usable by wheelchair users.
Okay. And my second question. I'm really looking at, you know, going forward in the future, having more places where we have gardens, where people can grow their food.
Hmm.
Is that something we might be able to do?
We've, issue's been raised, so thanks for the, for raising it. And what we've been, the developer's actually been looking into whether they can find a kind of provider or manager, essentially, that would show how that can be done and allow that to happen. So that's still somewhat in the air, but it's a concern that I think is a good one, that if it can be shown to be a viable portion of this project, then we intend to provide it.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Mr. Nagraj.
Well, these are beautiful elevations, as I told you earlier, and renderings. And so thanks for showing them to us. I actually had a question more for OHA on our end and Eric. And it has to do just with the mix of the different affordable housing types in this area and just how... For me personally, it's the highest number of units I've seen. Plus, the seems like a mix of family and senior. So I guess a question just generally of how we're doing in this area through indicators of whatever we want, whether it's how it's leasing, is crime okay, are we, services are going well, kind of generally. And then secondly, this mix with senior and family, which I know mm-hmm. some folks, different people feel differently about that. Mm-hmm. And I guess that question is, do we see this as kind of an integrated area of affordable and public housing, or is it really kind of different types that just happen to be next to each other that we don't really seem to, that we're not going to programmatically integrate?
I think the programmatically integrate will be actually a BALSI who will try and work if they're going to programmatically try and get the buildings. The buildings are independent, which I think does provide some peace for the seniors in a way. There was one development I was involved in years ago with West Hollywood Community Housing Corp where they had the senior and the family, and then they had a courtyard in between, and everybody when we built it said it wasn't going to work, and what happened is it really did work. And you had the seniors out in the courtyard watching the kids, and before they formed real relationships, and it was really a terrific project. This is designed a little differently. The lot is so large, this piece. It's a very dense piece of work, and I think that you know, one of the things that they should be commended for is how attractive they made the density look. It really is. The front is broken, and you know, they have the stone surface in one section. They've got the overhang at the top, which it just really, to me, that they solved a lot of that in the design. But the reality of it is we're putting a senior project into a development that didn't really service seniors, so that's a pretty good thing. I'm not certain of the status of the Kroger Market, but it's supposed to be right across the street, so you'd walk over to the park. That's a very good thing. The overall crime in the neighborhood is a problem, but in terms of the senior housing in the neighborhood, we have one development we just put a lot of money in, NARA, which is Palo Vista, about four blocks away. We have a wait list established for that, and we think we're going to have no trouble leasing it. There's a number of other project-based Section 8 and affordable housing senior projects in this neighborhood, just over a little bit, that a lot of the faith-based community has driven to create, and they are occupied, and there is a huge market for it. So I think that we will have a market for this. I think we need to be seen in this case as one of the drivers that's going to try and make the entire community healthier and safer, and that is the whole effort of the Hope 6 grant. And replacing Coliseum Gardens with a community that will work and that is integrated and that is accessible. I think the view of the park is great. I think that they have open space on two sides is great. And I think that there's enough people who live, work, and worship in that neighborhood that it's actually going to meet a need. So.
I just might add to Henry Cisneros, when he was Secretary of HUD, said the antidote for density is good design. And so the whole idea that essentially you can make higher density feel like it fits.
Yeah, but look where he is. Okay, any other questions, comments? Thank you so much, excellent.
Okay.
We like what we see.
Good, happy to hear.
Good,
thanks very much.
A newer picture. Okay, moving right along. Item C
is a resolution authorizing the executive director to continue the self-insured workers' compensation program for Bay Area Housing Risk Management Agency, BAHRMA, and to make the payment of the estimated premium for the year. This is an item that actually came to us too late to make the December meeting, so we're including it now. We are in a collaborative group, and Artesia Dupree would like to come up and give a brief description of what we do every year and some of the premium reductions we've experienced this year, and also maybe a bit about our dividends.
Good evening, commissioners. BAHRMA was established in 1984. It is a joint power between San Francisco Housing Authority and Oakland Housing Authority. At one time, we were a part of the state workers' compensation fund, and the premiums were quite high, and we weren't getting any dividends on the returns that we were as part of that group. So OHA made a decision to separate, and under this joint power, we became self-insured, and we met all the qualifications that HUD and the state of California said that we need to do. So we currently provide services to all of our injured workers. That component also has a piece where we do ergonomics for prevention of injury. So we try to look forward to kind of estimating if someone's going to have an injury and what can we do to avoid that injury. So currently we have this, the premium is for $2 million. That is driven by the number of employees that we have and the value of our injuries. So we're actually working to reduce that number. We currently have a dividend surplus that's available to Housing Authority, to Oakland, of $3.8 million. Since the inception of BAHRMA, we've only drawn down on our dividends three times, in 2003, 2004, and 2005, and that's prior to us having excess insurance. But we've since purchased our own, so we haven't had to draw down on that dividend. The minimum we can draw on that dividend right now is $2,555,000, if need be. So the money that's sitting in surplus, we currently have an interest rate on it, 3.75, so we are turning the money over and getting some interest on the money that's sitting there for us. But so far, the program works really well. OHA is well represented on that, to which I am a board member as well. Is there any questions regarding what it is? Yes.
Mr. Hartwig.
Yes, so so we essentially have a $3 and change million asset out there with regard to the yes, I see. Okay, good. Thank you.
That was the message you heard, yes. And it's currently invested, and it's there if we need it to pay off any claims that come our way.
Yes.
In the event that we need...
Is it limited to only claims?
No, we could recall it. It takes about 6 months if we wanted to pull on it.
Okay. Good. Thank you. I'll move the item.
I'll second.
Okay, it's been moved to the second. I have a question. Oh, okay. when you said that you were looking at reducing that number, it sounded like you were talking about the number of employees.
No.
The
that's number of injuries.
There you go.
Yeah, so what we're
that's
currently...
Let's clarify.
No. No, that is not what the purpose of the reduction is. The reduction is to reduce the number of our claims and the longevity, the length of them. So doing more safety training out in the field, doing more ergonomics, providing more equipment, things that can prevent injury from occurring or shorten the number of the length of those injuries, that if a person's out for... say a back injury and they're usually out for 3 months, seeing what we can do to bring them back sooner. So if there's anything, any ergonomics, any equipment, any strap, whatever it is, so that we can return those workers back, those injured workers back to work sooner. That's what reducing the number is.
Yes. That's what I wanted to
thank
hear.
You.
On
clarify.
The record.
No, we're going to stay strong with where
it's
we are.
Reducing it's injury and reducing the length of the claim. And, yeah. And the only other thing I'd add in terms of the reason we want to keep, I think historically the board has wanted to keep the, make sure that we had enough reserve in this area, is we do operate a police department. And so we want to make sure we can cover any claims that are coming our way.
Good.
Yes.
Okay. Ms. Hurd.
Question. How many injuries have we had?
Currently, for the past policy year, we had 13 injuries.
And what was the cost payout? Cost payout?
Hold on about 2 seconds. I'll tell you. The cost payout on the injuries for last year was $422,788 for Oakland Housing Authority for our injuries. And that included any future medical benefits that may have come along for settlements for claims that had run a period of time and we went ahead and they got their permanent and stationary status and we closed those claims. So that was included in that number.
Okay. Thank you.
Tim? Hello?
I'm done. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. I know she's over there taking notes. She's into it, but sometimes she's not done. So I got to ask that question. Okay. It's been moved.
Thank
it's
you.
Been seconded. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Thank you.
All those opposed? Any abstentions? Hearing none? It's unanimous. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioners.
Item D.
Item D is consideration of a resolution to authorize the Executive Director to execute an updated agreement with the California Public Employment Retirement System to provide for the employee and employer's pension contributions. Tony Ma, the Director of Finance, is available if you have any questions. I will give you my brief understanding of why we're doing this, is that it was missing from the original documents from us and a lot of other agencies. CalPERS is asking that you pass the resolution to correct something. Would that So we are correcting an action from a very, very, very long time ago.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I'm looking at this, and I see that
the same question.
Yeah, Jackie Castain was the one who signed this originally as the officer. We gave her an award for being on the commission several years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And
I see what we're doing.
Okay. Now
that just was a hard the English was confusing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Okay.
So this is
And this for the record, by the way, needs to be signed by the chair. So we're actually asking for the chair.
That's why I was looking at this one, because this one seemed to be signed by the chair.
And you will have this. You probably already have it on your desk waiting for approval.
But
yes, CalPERS likes things signed by the chair, not to delegate.
By the presiding officer.
Yep.
Okay. I think I get this.
Tanya Pitts.
All right. I found this one a little confusing, and I tried to go through to figure out what was going on. So I got to the last page, the resolution for employer pickup form, and it says we're addressing a decision that was made September 18th, 1985. And I couldn't find that in here. I was wondering if that was a typo and it was supposed to be September 8th, 1980, when this actually went into effect. And
it is a typo on
their It is a typo on their resolution, and we will have to have them correct it. Or,
okay. So yeah. This, we've got the proper resolution in front of us.
Yes.
Okay.
And you've got the correct resolution in front of you from the action in 1980, and we send it in, they can make the correction. But I would like, that's a very good catch in that we could do the motion to approve the corrected date on the resolution when they submit it to us.
Excellent. That makes it a lot clearer than it was previously.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm going to assume that it takes a while for the legal office to catch up with what the board has done, because obviously it was signed in May, and then in September it was signed by the legal office. What's up with that?
Had Commissioner Pitts not caught the date request, I think we probably in about 20 years would have gotten a request to correct the resolution.
Yeah. Okay.
She would have picked it up in 20 years.
Mr. Hartwig.
Yeah, so in effect, we are authorizing what's been happening.
Yeah.
Again.
I would just like to say that I am very pleased to see how much this entire organization has progressed since the dark ages. It's really wonderful. And I would be happy to move the item.
Yes, thank you. Good.
Yes.
But change the date.
With the modified.
With the modified, yes. Yeah.
Corrected. And
indeed.
I feel like me use pen.
Nagraj was
there. Actually, Mr. Yeah. Nagraj is looking. She's thirding it. Okay, it's been moved and seconded and thirded. All those in favor, please say aye. All those opposed, same sign. Any abstentions? It's unanimous. Done. Let's move on to item E.
Item E. Item E is approval of a contract amendment with the Goldfarb & Lipman LLP to increase the not-to-exceed amount by $250,000 for the current option term for general counsel legal services. We bid this contract out, I believe, in 2009 and projected what costs would be going forward. It has 5 years' worth of total terms on it. The current term had a figure that we want to now increase. We've had some additional legal expenses related to some policy development, but also in HR doing some arbitrations and negotiations. So those two areas early in the contract year took more billable hours than we were anticipating. And on another aside, this is gonna be the, we've had a 2 year and one option term. So we're at 3 years, and we've actually decided internally that we're gonna bid out all of our legal services again as a block, and then come back to you sometime in the next probably 6 months with new contract amounts. HUD, you can do up to 5 years, but they prefer you not to and to go out more frequently. And so we expect to come back to you with new contracts probably in 6 months.
I think they're going to have to leave the room while we have a discussion on this. I'm just kidding. Just kidding. I had a look deer in the headlights. So, your will and pleasure. Any discussion on this?
Move the item.
Thank you.
Second.
It's been moved. It's been seconded. That was Ms. Pitts that seconded. Any more discussion, conversation, questions? Hearing none. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the same sign. Any abstentions? It's unanimously carried.
Thank you, Commissioners. F. Item F is a presentation of discussion of the 2011 Oakland Housing Authority Police Department Resident Opinion Survey. Every couple of years, the police department does a resident opinion survey, and looking back, I don't think the board has had the opportunity to see it in the past. And this year I read it and I called the chief because I thought it was sort of an amazing document of where we are in tracks over time, and specifically related to Lockwood, where we've had a lot of resident concerns and community concerns and we've been working so hard to address. The chief is out this week, as some of you know, but Lieutenant Coates is here to provide a presentation of the survey, why we do it, and what we've learned.
Good evening, Commissioners. Since 1999, the Oakland Housing Authority Police Department has conducted biannual citizen surveys of our residents. The purpose of the surveys is to improve our overall performance as a police department. It utilizes three key areas, including public perception, service experience, and neighborhood safety, and utilizes six areas, key measures that we use to that we found to have the greatest impact on the perception of police services as we provide them. By utilizing the surveys to gauge our overall performance, the police department has been able to increase our level of service and the perceptions of our competence from 65% in 2009 to 92% as of the survey in 2011. A copy of the survey was provided in your board packages, and I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have them. Yes, sir.
Mr. Hardwick, he's over here. I could hear him making all these comments. I'm like,
yes, thank you. That going from 65%, I think you said it was.
Yes, sir.
Back in 09 to what
92% of the survey
to 92 now. I'm just curious, what is it that you feel accounted? I mean, that's a pretty dramatic increase, and I'm just wondering what actions the department has taken in order to drive that kind of change in that shorter period of time, because that's only 3 years or 2 years. It's actually 2 years.
We implemented a number of different training programs, including training in customer service, dealing with difficult customers, increased our training in bias-based profiling, changed policy in order to reflect current practice and as it's put out by the Commission for the Accreditation on Law Enforcement Agencies as it pertains to bias-based profiling. Mostly it was in the area of training. We felt that 65%, while is better than half, wasn't satisfactory for us. It wasn't satisfactory for the chief or the command staff. So we set out to change that through our training programs.
I see. So it was really training, and just I'm just curious. I mean, what can you give me an example of a situation where the training produced a different result than might have just a few years ago?
One of the areas that we did training on was emotional survival for law enforcement, and one of the things that officers don't tend to realize is how they're perceived by the public. We tend to approach things from the perspective that we'd rather be safe than sorry. We definitely want our officers to go home at the end of their shift. However, that level of hypervigilance, when it's perceived by a citizen on a car stop, we don't know who that citizen is. We don't know if they're America's Most Wanted or just a regular, just a citizen who's just coming home from work and happened to miss that red light. So one of the things that we did is attempt to make officers aware of how sometimes their hypervigilance is perceived by the general public. So the more they're aware of those type of issues and more they're aware of the public's perception, the more that they can tailor their behavior to put the citizens more at ease.
And now the final question is OPD going to hire you guys to give them some of this training as well?
Trick question.
No, I'm just kidding. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, sir.
Ms. Pitts?
Yeah, I also found this document fascinating and lots of excellent information on it. I thought it would be interesting when I was reading over it, since it started in 1998. Next year would be 15 years that you guys have been doing it, to see an overall trend chart. Kind of mapping the progress and where it's gone. So I don't know if that would be possible next year, the 15-year anniversary of doing it, but I think it would be an interesting thing to look at.
Mm-hmm. Aye, ma'am.
Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Hurd.
Yeah, I'm glad you raised that question, because
I've been studying the city of Oakland's crime maps, and one thing I learned from them is where crime is taking place in neighborhoods. And when I looked at this, two of the areas I focused in is community involvement, and we have high percentage rates on those. And I want to know, what is our plan going forward to decrease that?
To increase the level increase of community
that.
Involvement?
To yes. increase the level. I mean, what it's a just it's one it's the thing that stood out totally on me when I read this. Yeah. If you look at it's the top of what is your level of community involvement.
Right.
You've got the overall bit. If you go to Peralta Village, we got 33% of the people surveyed in West Oakland were participating in a community police and community involvement. And I would tell you that Peralta is one of our safest, most perceived safe developments. It's also our largest. And I thought that was just amazing. So then you go over to the next page, which is the scattered sites, and we only have 13%. Then you go to the senior sites, and we do an astounding 47. And Lockwood, which is on one of these, is in between. It's 28%. And Lockwood, as you know, the perception of safety in Lockwood is one of the biggest concerns of our residents. I was surprised we got 28% of the residents who were participating. And I think that if we did your tracking chart, you would see over the past 2 years a jump based on the work that OPD and Family Community Partnerships and OPO are doing out there right now. Mm-hmm. And so the plan is to keep doing more so we can get the numbers up and try and solve the scattered site issue. But I think our major focus right now in terms of strategic planning for safety is West and East Oakland in the 100 block area.
Okay. So are we going to talk to residents about how they can be involved?
Yes, ma'am. Our crime prevention officers and our patrol officers are both engaged in the process of interacting with our tenants and encourage them, if they're not only encourage them to participate in the NCPC meetings, the block yes. parties, National Night Out, but also to participate in meetings for their own complexes.
Okay.
Lockwood, in particular, officers have started going building by building. To get residents involved in the community that way, and then bring them together in larger groups so that they can participate. One area that we were successful in is Keller Plaza, which is not directly owned by the Housing Authority.
But it is now.
It is. Okay. So Keller Plaza was one of the areas that we've been successful in getting the community together as a group to address some of the concerns and issues that they had, and been pretty successful in reducing the perception of crime in their neighborhood.
And we've also entered into MOUs with Mandela Gateway to help provide some services to the management company there and that property. That's a very important property for people in West Oakland, because you walk through it to get to and from. Our residents in Peralta, a lot of the Acorn residents walk through that gateway in the West Oakland BART stop to and from their work and home. So I think that getting those kind of MOUs in place is essential to us being able to improve our community policing efforts. And one of the things I know that we do that we do really well, and that I think is one of the things that the city looks toward how we do it, is the way we engage our community with the police. We really are focused on two areas in our police department, and that one of them is community policing. How do you create a safer neighborhood? And the other one is investigations. And they're somewhat tied, but those are really our main cruxes.
Thank you. Thank you for doing the report. Thank you.
Council Bell.
I just wanted to make a comment. A few years ago, and I think I've said this to some of you, there was an officer-involved shooting, and the chief asked me to go to the police department while he had asked the Oakland Homicide Department to investigate it, because he didn't want to have it investigated himself. He wanted to have a totally impartial investigation. The officer was totally exonerated, and just sort of during downtime, I was talking to a couple of the housing and the homicide detectives who basically said they were super impressed with OHAPD. They said... one said, I've been an officer 31 years, and I think this is the second time there's been a shooting. They just do an incredible job. I don't know how they do it. And in a conversation with the chief, he told me that OHAPD has more, like eight times as many non-lethal, basic training to do non-lethal interventions, you know, like talk to people before you shoot them. and so, but I thought that was, you know, I think it's very important to know that OPD has a high regard for OHAPD.
So are you saying that we have much better shootings?
No, I'm saying we don't shoot.
Oh, okay.
we stop crime without shooting.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Montgomery.
Yeah, I'd like to thank you, too, because the OHA officers are always attending my NCPC meetings. In fact, this past Tuesday night, they were there. And Oakland's officers were down at the council meeting because of the Occupy movement. So then the OPD officers, I asked to give me a report. So he obliged and did do it. What we are doing, our next move is we're working on getting into the communities to find out how we can get the message out to the residents concerning the our meetings, because I noticed in the report some of them don't have any, don't participate in the neighborhood council meetings. And so this is our next move, and as chairman of B2X, I'm going to work on that. So, but thank you for the officer that he comes every month. So we're very proud of that, to get some type of information back to the residents, what's going on.
You're welcome, ma'am.
Mr. Hartwig.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just thought that I would extend on what Jennifer said, because this is really important. These ratings are highly meaningful. If you go around the city of Oakland and talk to people who have encountered OHAPD as well as other departments, when they find out that OHAPD is going to be dealing with a problem, I mean, they are just in a state literally of joy. They are soothed. They feel like, thank God, something might happen. And I am not kidding. Anybody else coming in, it is not the same. It is not the same. So I really applaud. I think this is a... this is really fantastic what OHAPD has done here. And not only that, but if you were to go around the country, you would not find very many police departments that have this level of respect from people that have had interactions with them. So thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, Mr. DeGrasse.
So just a quick point that's been said before that I want to reiterate. It would be great. So just that discrete point about looking. I want to make sure that, given the amount of work that's gone into this, that there is deep conversation and communication, essentially with family community partnerships. And so even that discrete point that you made, that higher involvement in your NCPC means lower, you know, if there's indeed a correlation, it means. Mm-hmm. Generally lower crime or perception of crime. And so how does family and community partnership help use these to drive our programming? Mm-hmm. To the extent that that could be done in a structural way. So what are the four or five takeaways that we're getting from this? What are four or five takeaways we're getting from this, and how can we create proactive programming on the front end to help address some of this stuff? So even that example that Lieutenant gave, which that's like a heartbreaking example that you were saying of, you're stopping a car, you have to be beefed up for the worst case scenario. It might be some guy who feels like he's been, you know, stopped all the time, and who's this cop? Why does he got to pull a gun, or whatever that means to you guys, being fully prepared. I could see like both sides of that, and I have sympathy for both sides of that. And again, that is a direct role for family community partnerships, I think, to play in some of the messaging and communication. So it would be great to create some kind of structure where this and FCP can work together to create some proactive programming.
And, you know, even just to reiterate the difference, I mean, we have the citywide, which I think is always important. So 49% of the people citywide have some concern about our homes being broken into. But you go to Lockwood Gardens, 70% of the people there. You know, a really disproportionately larger number of people have a very real concern. And that's something that family and community partnerships with OPD can use to help organize people in. We know you're worried about this, and this is what we can do to try and make your neighborhood safer. And the only thing, I mean, I say it all the time these days, really, is that Oakland is not going to be able to police itself out of its current problem. It's going to have to be the residents of Oakland are the people who have to make this city safer. And to the extent that our police department can help facilitate that, family and community partnerships can help facilitate that. And OPO can help facilitate that is the only way we're going to get there.
Okay. Any other comments? Ms. Montgomery, you're on.
Yes, just recently, the mayor has created, I don't have all of the information, but it's called the 100 Block Initiative. And I think starting in March, there will be several workshops. I know two in East Oakland, one in West Oakland. And this will be to target, I think, the 16 through 18-year-old for summer jobs and other programs. But at least she's working on some of the neighborhoods that are most affected by crime. So more information will be coming out concerning a 100 block program initiative. So this is to help the housing that's in these various communities that are having problems. So more information will be coming forward.
We are working closely with the Oakland Police Department as far as the 100 block things, just ensuring that as we go forward with our partnership with them, that we also remain focused on our sites.
And I would say that in the 100 block, a couple of the mappings when they were doing it, we had conversations early on with them to include a couple of our developments that were not necessarily going to be included just because of the partnership and because we're so concerned about the surrounding neighborhood.
And just today, the Housing Authority confirmed as part of the mayor's initiative, one of her job fairs for the youth as part of 100 Block will be held at Lockwood Gardens. So we actually hosted one. Cool.
Let's get them together before we have that. Lockwood Gardens, Target.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other comments? Questions?
Thank you.
Presentation, thank you. Well done.
Thank you, sir.
We'll give you another accommodation for that. Moving right along. Yes. Actually, sort of. We have some people wishing to address the commission. Robin Johnson and Betty Wright. Robin Johnson, you're first.
All right. Hi, I'm Robin Johnson, and I'm here tonight with a couple of requests for you guys. My first request is, last year I experienced some inconvenience with my landlord, and the Housing Authority was involved. They put some letters in my file I want removed. At the time, I didn't have all the information to show them I wasn't lying, and there was an issue about credibility, I guess. I want my credibility substantiated. And that's why I also want another letter removed out of my file. One of the inspectors put down that I had just, I had an inspection, and at the inspection, there's roaches running around, and I denied the unit. I would have thought the unit would have failed because it didn't pass. But no, they said that was my fault, that I should have took it. I didn't feel it was worth taking, and violations. This is just for my credibility. After study, recently I went through some hearings with Eric, through the executive route, I guess, procedures. And it was over my FSS participation. And while going through my record, I saw a lot of things had been left out. A lot of things had been left out, and that's why I'm asking for the correction here. But in the meantime, while that issue has moved on to another stage, I need to request a written record of the transcript from the hearings, from the whole process. Under the process, I guess, a transcript of the recordings. There were hearings where we had recordings and stuff like that. Also, I need to request for, what is this one? Oh, there was, well, I want the whole recording of the information, but immediately, I guess I came to a meeting in July of last year, on the 25th, and at that meeting, I informed you guys that I'd been wrongfully evicted by OPD, and I need a copy of that hearing, because, for other reasons. And I guess my last request is for payment from your administrative fund. When I moved into that unit, OHA had made a miscalculation on my portion of the rent. I spent the past 2 years baiting it with them. It can't get resolved. I provided as much information as possible. The calculations were wrong. How they came up with my portion of the income, it's been reviewed. Their information was incorrect. They calculated in welfare income I wasn't receiving at the time. And I did submit a proposed decision from an administrative law judge who found that I wasn't in receipt at the time. So, anyhow, that's what I'm here for. My payment.
May I ask you a question?
Sure.
Did you provide any of these requests to staff so far?
Yeah, I actually submitted it to you for the request for the payment for the overpayment or the underpayment. I submitted that back in February, I guess it was April 2009 when I got notice that my portion of the rent had been transposed. They said, first thing they told me that what my portion was, I agreed. Then they said they had made a mistake in their calculations. And I said, no, you didn't. They said that the original part was because they had recalculated my income based on their findings, but then they put it to a higher amount. I submitted it then. I submitted it to Griesley when he was here. They dropped it and asked me for a bunch of documents. They dropped the issue. They said they were going to terminate me. I requested an informal hearing on it. But then I recently found out I really don't need an informal hearing since it's a matter of, something about if I owed you money, then you have a bunch of ways of going after it from me. So that's why I'm here. It was, But it's recently been brought up to Eric, so.
Oh,
in your name.
You
so,
said
yeah.
me, because I'm thinking like, I don't remember ever talking to you.
No, I tried to. They said I had to go through Eric's office first. And I spoke with him, Michelle, and Janet on it. And so, yeah.
Okay.
But it's been 2 years,
Okay. So, obviously, we're not going to address it here. That's not what we do, okay? Only because it's not on the agenda as an item.
Yeah, but okay? Should it have been? I wanted it on the agenda. I've asked for it to be on the agenda.
Okay. Well, it's not on the agenda.
Okay.
Okay. Well. You're bringing it to us right now.
Okay.
We have no documentation to support what you're saying or to repute it or to substantiate it or anything, okay? All we're doing is listening to you right now.
Okay.
And we're going to refer you back to staff so they can advise you on what your steps are that you can take, okay? Because if you're asking for a hearing, that's a whole other story.
No, I don't need a hearing. I just need to get paid.
Well, you don't get paid without a hearing. By the way, there are steps that you have to take. It just doesn't come like, okay, sure, no problem. It doesn't happen here, okay?
Okay.
Just trying to be real with you.
Okay.
Okay. So we're going to have to refer you back to staff. And Mr. Eric Johnson, who you've talked to before,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure will be glad to reiterate some of the things he's probably said before and mm-hmm. give you some direction that you need to take, okay? And if that's done timely, then we may be able to help you, but if it's not, then that's a whole other issue.
I just want to interject one thing about it, the request for the information in the file. I mm-hmm. wrote it down, but I want to make sure I'm right. If you mm-hmm. can send me an email of exactly what you're looking for,
okay.
So we get the right stuff. The other thing I just want to mention, if it was a board meeting that you attended, you needed that testimony,
mm-hmm.
what you're doing now, those are posted on the website as a PDF. If you want us to burn you one, okay. Let me know. All right?
Been there, and actually that one, it has the minutes in it. It recognizes that I was here, but it doesn't have...
The audio wasn't working. Anyway, send me the date, and we'll see if we can get it for you. All right?
Okay. And then I'm going to wrap up just with an opportunity for... No. I'm going to pass on that one. We're going to just move forward. Okay?
Okay.
Thank you.
Miss Betty Wright, you're on. Someone's going to help you with the mic.
Good evening to the executive director and the commissioners and those who are seated behind me. I attended my first RAB meeting in October, and at that time I brought before the board my concerns for better accessibility in the doorways and bathrooms of your new construction buildings. I understand that there is some construction already ongoing. The interior work is already going on, so they cannot be adjusted. But for future construction of new buildings where you are going to have disabled units, much, much, much attention must be given to the hallways, to the doorways, and to the bathrooms. All motorized wheelchairs are not the same size. All regular wheelchairs are not the same size. All of the walkers are not the same size in width. I live at Madison Park Apartments. It's over 100 years old. So I know that no adjustments can be made. I have 3/4 of an inch clearance in my doorway. I cannot use my chair in my apartment. I have to use a walker. Accessibility to my bathroom, I cannot use my walker. I have to hold on to the wall and the bathtub in order to get to the toilet. You need better accessibility in the new buildings. Number two, the bathroom. I wish and I hopefully pray that at some point there will be enough money allocated that we can have the step-in tubs for the disabled. I know for a fact that if you buy enough of them, you get a really good discount. Our tubs are not made for the disabled. They're too low. If you put bars on the wall, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And all of the portable handles that you can purchase do not work on all types of tubs. I went through 17 different types of bars with my occupational therapist. None of them work because our tubs are the old, beautiful iron lion claw tub. But even with the new ones, they are so low. It's too low for us to go down into. Three, the toilet stool. With all of the cuts that are being done for senior citizens, and particularly those of us who are disabled, we should not have to go out and purchase a polythene plastic elevated seat to fit on the toilet. It is still too low. We should not have to go out and purchase the bar that fits around the toilet stool. We still have a problem going down that low to sit on the toilet stool. So having the bars, as one person said, well, you go out and buy the bars, you can use it. You still have to physically go down and come up. And I realize that contractors are trying to help the product maker. I know for a fact that the higher toilet stool is still being manufactured. We don't have to use the low slim boy, particularly in the disabled bathrooms. It's very, very important. Equally so, I want to touch on, I didn't put it on my note, but I also want to touch on the kitchens in the new construction buildings. Remember, we are still in a motorized wheelchair. We've got to be able to maneuver in that kitchen. So if you make it L-shaped and make it compact, just remember that in that short L, we have to be able to turn the corner, sit in front of the sink, then we've got to be able to turn the corner and open the refrigerator door, which is right up against the stove, or if you open the oven door, it's right up against the refrigerator. Not enough attention is given to these areas for the disabled. I was told at the October RAB meeting that there was a group of disabled people who had been meeting with the architects, and all of this was being addressed. And that after the first of the year, these same architects would come to one of the RAB meetings that we could discuss more one-on-one with them. It hasn't happened yet, and I know it's just the first of the year. But my concern is because I'm hearing talk tonight at my first commissioner meeting about new construction going on, particularly what Ebalzi is going to do. And I am very, very concerned. I have been looking at senior housing just in case I should happen to move from Ebalzi. And I refuse to move. What I'm seeing that is listed for disabled, it's not for a disabled person. Besides that, I don't want to lose my gas stove, and I don't like the new electric stoves that are going on the senior housing. But these are issues that if you are not disabled, you kind of push it to the side. Or you say, oh, well, we can do this, and that'll be good enough for them. We are very important people. And I didn't know just how important I was until this past July when I had to go to this chair. It's been a terrible, terrible adjustment because I'm a go-getter. I'm a very active person, and I am finding out there are so many things that I am being limited in doing because the facility is not accessible in terms of width going through doorways, hallways that are so narrow, it makes it hard. The first hallway that I come into from my apartment, I have exactly 3 inches to turn around to be able to go out. And then I have a 1-inch clearance on either side, having just come through a doorway where I only have 3/4 of an inch. And I think I'm a pretty good driver, but this chair has taught me I got to go back to school. It's very hard. So I'm asking that in the newer plans for construction of buildings where you are going to have disabled units, think hard, think twice, think 3 times before you make these decisions. There is much to be considered. And I hate to say it, but quite a few people are becoming more disabled than ever, and it's not planned, but it happens. And you cannot make a comment about it till you put on our shoes and have to go through what we have to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Wright. And I guess, Eric, the question here is really twofold. Do we have a process by which a resident, when something changes in their lives like this, is there a procedure for them to go, so that there's a communication, and then we advise them what's possible, what's not possible?
There is, and it's called the 504 reasonable accommodation process, both Section 8 and OPO. So if they had to move to a different unit, which is not what Ms. Wright wants to do,
right.
What I just want to say is how much I appreciate her coming tonight and sharing the reality of trying to live in a space that was not designed for someone. Mm-hmm. The design specifications on new construction are designed to whatever the codes are for different accessibilities. Not every unit is for everyone with a mobility impairment. Mm-hmm. There are different levels of it. And the trick is to match the right person with the right unit, which has always been a challenge for everybody providing that kind of housing. Mm-hmm. But I think the thing that I was particularly struck with was the unique level of detail that Ms. Wright is able to do in expressing
exactly
what needs to happen. Mm-hmm. And why I wanted Patricia to run and get her number is because I think it's worthwhile for us, when we get design unit reviews, to have someone look at it from that perspective and say, is this enough?
Yeah, that was actually the second part of my
question. And I think that's a whole different,
good,
separate thing than just building to the code, because we build to the code. And in some units, that's going to be perfect for someone. In some units, it may not. And I think that I think her insights are really invaluable.
Okay, good. So you're going to have a communication set up. Okay, thank you. Thank you. Adi.
So thank you very much for coming. I wheeled around my father for the last 5 years of his life, and I am incredibly sympathetic to what you're saying. What we do at my nonprofit is that we are able, and I don't know if OHA is able, to do preferential leasing for new buildings. So I understand you're saying that it's possible that even the new buildings may not have everything. They certainly would be better than the older building that you're in. Would it be possible for us to do preferential leasing to our current tenants before we open
there,
up generally?
There absolutely is. And in fact, it was driven by a former commissioner, and we made a change to our ACOP. And the ACOP allows us to go out and search for someone whose disability requirements meet the unit that we have available, rather than to house somebody without a disability in the unit because they're next on the list. Mm-hmm. And we don't have anyone on our list who meets that criteria. So now we're able to actually call up other organizations and attract people who want to live there that could most take advantage of those accessibility features of that unit. And we never had that before. That was one of our last changes, I think, 2 years ago. That we made to the ACOP and on all of the OP sites and the public housing sites. So any unit that we're leasing as a landlord, if we have it's accessible unit, we can go out and reach out to any organization, individual who can apply to try and fill their unit with the right. Because that's the big disconnect in all of these laws. It's if you don't have someone on your wait list, and we weren't tracking to the detail we do now mm-hmm. in our old system, then how do you match the person to the unit?
Right.
It's the challenge. Yeah.
And we do find it, Michelle Vassan, leased housing, we do find instances, I'm the 504 coordinator, where someone's in a unit and they need a reasonable accommodation, and we'll try to work with the owner, property manager, to see if they have another unit that will accommodate the family, and then try to help them through that process of moving if there's another unit available.
Thank you. Did you have a question?
I just wanted to thank you because, you know, when I was in the wheelchair, I live in the same building as she does, and I totally can agree to what she's saying because when I was in the wheelchair, I couldn't get around the apartment either, mm-hmm. and it was very, very uncomfortable, and as much as the older buildings, they can't accommodate you like mm-hmm. new ones, but my question was, When we bring someone off of our wait list and they're in a wheelchair, do we go to that building with them? Do we do a walkthrough with them?
They have to be there for the initial inspection. Okay. So off the Section 8 wait list, they actually select the unit that okay. works for them. But we are there in terms of inspecting the unit, and our inspector is there as well. Okay. For PVV units, initially they're working with the building, okay. and then they get referred to us. So normally the PVVs that are new construction, they're looking for individuals who actually have need accessible units, maybe in wheelchairs and have some limitations. So we go out with them during the inspection. Mm-hmm. Whether or not the family is able to verbalize that the unit is going to actually meet their needs, you know, they would have to make that decision in terms of the Section 8 voucher.
Okay. I had another question I was thinking about. People on our wait list, isn't there something that they check that tells us they're disabled?
Yes.
There is now, yeah.
There is now? Okay.
Mm-hmm. We don't know what the disability is, mm-hmm. but they do note whether they are disabled.
Okay, so we wouldn't know if they're in a wheelchair or they can't see or...
For wheelchair, yes. But if it's another disability, we probably wouldn't know. And we wouldn't really know what it was when they came in, you know, unless they disclosed it to us and we don't ask. Okay. We assume competency. The family then would have to tell us what kind of functional limitations they have okay. and how we could help them assess the units that they need.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else? Okay. Well, Mrs. Wright, I again want to thank you for coming in because this is the kind of information that this commission really appreciates. And so does the Housing Authority, because this is really, I mean, this is how we get better. And so I am very hopeful that the kind of information you have been providing, especially the wonderful detail that you provided, is going to end up perhaps making some very, very real changes. So thank you.
Okay, are you retaking
You can keep
your command here.
Okay.
Moving on.
Okay, so moving on now to written communications.
Good evening, Commissioners. The written communications, we have two monthly reports. That's for December and October. Catching you up. If you have any questions, staff's available. Yes, November and December's. The next one, the next memo in your packet I really want to call attention to, and that's the Resident Advisory Board memo. It's got that it occurred, but behind it is something that was provided by the RAB completed their vision for 2012. Mm-hmm. And Jenny Castillo really, I think, wanted to be here tonight to talk about it, so I may actually include it in next month's package as well. But also, Commissioner Hurd has been directly involved in helping create the RAB vision and what this says. I just think it's an amazing document, and I think we need to take some time with it. So make sure you can look at it. It just lays out what their priorities are for us and the community, and I think it's a kind of powerful that we got to this point at the beginning of the year, and I'm really proud of everybody who worked on it, all the RAB, and Commissioner Castillo, who really shepherded the whole group into a consensus. The next is a letter that we received that Chief Duplessis and I received related to some work we've been doing in the community, and I just wanted to share it with you. It's there was another email that I didn't share, but it was very, very nice of the individuals who took time to write this at the end of December. And the email that I got had one comment in it that just really kind of made my holiday worthwhile, and that was we had a problem several years ago in this neighborhood, and both the chief, Patricia, and I took quite a beating, to say the least. And in the email, the person who was shepherding the group said, I just wanted you to know that we should have given you a chance and we were wrong. And I thought that was really powerful of the group to say that. I just wanted to include the letter that we did have the acceptance of the Move to Work, annual Moving to Work report letter. We got a thank you letter from Center Force for one of the summits that some of our folks attended. Included a fairly lengthy for HUD response to our request that was actually signed on by 10 different housing authorities related to a notice they published. HUD is currently in a mode, or has been at least to date in the last year, where rather than take on any real legislative changes with Congress or anything real with Congress, what they're doing is doing a negotiated rulemaking process or noticing. This was a notice they published for clarity. The notice opened. This notice substantially changed the MTW game, we thought, in many ways. They were going on record in what they thought or had agreed with the Office of Business OBM management in terms of what they're allowed to do. We have some real concerns with it, as do my other 9 colleagues in the West Coast that we got involved in it. We were the lead letter writer, so it came back to us. But and I really want to thank Anna Gwen Simpson, by the way, for getting everybody together and making our case. We each had an example of every problem we rose in the notice. We gave a specific example of something each one of us were working on that would be derailed by the notice. For us, our biggest concern was trying to develop housing for some of the emancipated foster youth in Alameda County and using some of our disposed of property in that way. And what they came back with is basically you have to weigh it against whether or not you want to use MTW funds, because if you use MTW funds, you have to record a 30-year affordability on that property, which is the process we just went through to get removed. And our counter was MTW only goes through 2018, and we're trying to get some folks, some useful life in this property. And lastly, there's no market for the property. I would rather put it to use now and in 10 or 15 years decide what you want to do with it. So we're going to find another way. It may involve some of our instrumentalities, like CAHI, to have them be the lead and take over, or OPI, we're not sure. We've got to find a way to somehow make better use of some of to solve some of the problems we're facing. Unfortunately, it was just really disheartening for a lot of us that HUD would get that so controlling, and it's a period that they're going through. And there's this notice, there's a capital fund notice we're waiting for. There's been a series of them that we've commented on to the point where I think that they must run when they see me and if I walk. Because I do express myself quite aggressively. The last expression had to do with our disposition application for the senior sites. HUD has been literally sitting on applications for a year. We're not alone. So I happen to be in a small group meeting with the assistant secretary and pose the question, does this administration support disposition or what? None of us have heard anything. I haven't heard anything since February 20th. and there's a backlog of different agencies. So we were able, actually, with my raising the issue, to get conference calls arranged for everybody who had pending disposition applications, and there's going to be some movement. I hear from a colleague in this area, which I won't name on the record, who's got a pending application and was not in that meeting, but I called her as soon as I got out. And she got a conference call that she's expecting a letter in the next week or so, so I'm anxious to hear. These are people kind of ahead of us in the queue. Anna Gwen and I have been working very, very hard with on a letter and some responses with them since the call, and with Rod Solomon, our attorney, on it, to get the letter crafted. We're now pretty much at a final. We expect to get it out this week. We're not in that stage where they're going to say yes or no yet. We're still in a different stage, and if we can make the cases correctly at this point, then we stand a better chance. But what is really clear is they're shutting the door, which is something we've known was going to happen. And what is really clear to me is they want anything that can fit their new RAD, rental assistance demonstration, which used to be PETRA, preservation of da-da-da, or TETRA before demonstration, because they do have authority for it. The even though they have authority for RAD, they don't have any funding for it. So if they can't use things like the replacement vouchers we get awarded as the second step of disposition, they don't have any money to implement. Earlier this week, I think I sent out an update of some legislation that's pending in Washington. Why that's important: A, it makes move to work permanent, which I think would solve a lot of our issues, and it would put me in a lot different mode in terms of our planning and strategic planning with you, because we're not going to have to worry about it all stopping and preparing for that date. We actually can prepare longer. And that alone would be a godsend. But the other thing it does is it puts actual funding behind the RAD. And I think that the fight internally with HUD will be less when they actually have funding allocation to the program. So they're not looking at trying to steal resources from other processes like demolition, disposition, Section 8 tenant protection vouchers, which is what they're doing. So I would expect us to probably push this along in the next 2 months or so and get some response from them. But they've been historically really slow, and I think we've unplugged it. Whether we've unplugged it in a good or bad way has yet to be determined, but I finally just got to a point is, if you don't want this to go forward, tell us. Don't leave us in limbo. Don't leave it in limbo in the PIC system with HUD, where we can't change it, and the local office is frustrated. Anna Kadanovskaya is tired of trying to explain it to everybody in HUD. Once they freeze it, they freeze it, and we can't move units. So we need to just get it resolved one way or the other. I do believe that they've done kind of a little backpedaling, and they're more supportive of the pending applications, and they are publishing a notice, a new notice on disposition in the coming weeks. It's been going through clearances, and in a local office here, they're going to host a conference that several of us are going over to on the new disposition law. The reason we're going, or their new notice, because I'm sorry, they're not creating law, right? Where they're trying to close the door and be able to say no. The CFR, the Code of Federal Regulations, does not give them very much leeway to say no. And so they're trying to figure out how they can strengthen that with this notice. What we're told is that it's not going to impact pending applications, but I'm not necessarily trusting in that advice. All right, I'll get off that one. and I included a couple of news articles that we were in, just so you would have them as reference, and we were mentioned in The Nation against related to our voucher opening. I find it amazing, the life of the internet. Once you get in the press, it just keeps recurring for, I guess, infinity. And then we have the schedule. I do want to let you know that April 9th we will be having a special meeting, as we had planned for the MTW plan. So we are going to need to have that April 9th meeting to meet HUD's deadlines of starting and stopping and making it all
in
work. Yeah, more than likely we'll have both. It'll probably be just that item at that meeting. Historically, okay. That's all we've done. We've kept it very short.
On the 9th?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. A couple other announcements. As you know, we've made several different permanent appointments. A couple other highlights from the month. That I'll do that next on my comments. Do we have any questions on the reports or written materials?
Written reports, no.
Nope.
Looks like no.
No. Wow. All right. My comments for the next one are we had the Campbell Village opening of their center again. We opened it on about the 19th, and it was open. I'm going to try and get a report at the end of the month from the asset management. It's managed through a sort of partnership between Family and Community Partnerships and the John Stewart Company. We're able to make some very decent improvements to that center. And my challenge to all of us is, how do we make that center actually provide a service that people want to come in and use? What kind of programming, what kind of activities? What we did was put a lot of sign-up sheets out on a table with different activities we could provide and let the community kind of drive what we're using there. One of the interesting things about it is everybody around the neighborhood has an idea of what they think that building is. It's a rec center, it's a teen center, it's a community. And what I know is it's a very small building that's a community building available for people to gather and do and sort of be safe. What we've done is add some basketball courts that were pretty torn up in the courtyard behind it. So it now has basketball. We've added two gaming stations with screens for Wii and for 360 Xbox, which I think will attract some of the youth in the neighborhood to come. And most significantly, with OTX, we've gotten all of the computer lab hooked up. When it was with Parks and Recs, they got donated computers from Nancy Mandel, the council member, 5 years ago. They were never hooked up. And we were able to get Bill Blue out to do that. And I just, that's that, the Oakland Net. And really on pretty short notice, because when we were trying to plug them in, we thought they would work, but they had gotten to a point where they didn't, so we were able to get new ones in and get it all open. The opening was really successful. Since then, it's been sporadic, the attendance, and I think the challenge for all the staff there is to really design things that work. One of the things they have is a walking group. The mayor showed up. She had a great suggestion, which is the walking group now reports graffiti in the neighborhood. You know, so when they come back from their walks, they can, we call in the graffiti request. I think that was wonderful. Nancy Nadell showed up. I think she was really pleased that we kind of made it as nice as we did. But I always figure I want it to be something that community really values. I want them to walk in there and really value that this is their center and this is their building and this is their space that can be safe and going to lift everyone up. And so I'm going to be watching it really carefully. The other thing I just want to mention, we had several staff get promoted permanently this month, and I just want to go down the list. One, we have a new staff from the outside, Shelby Aquiano. Shelby, raise your hand. Shelby is our director of Office of Property Operations, so she does all our management operations, and she comes to us as a she knows Oakland very well, and she knows property management very well, and I think she's been with us a few weeks now. When did you start? Two? Okay. 2 weeks. So she's got a learning curve, but I'm really excited about having the new energy. Anna Kadanovskaya, raise your hand. Anna is the director of asset management and is going to be working as a director to manage the portfolios that are in the mixed finance that we've just heard some concerns about how that works, but also the ones we have under contract, for example, this building with Satellite. We have Flo Lewis. Flo, raise your hand. Flo Lewis is the permanent director of human resources and I think has done in the past year just a really wonderful job in the acting capacity. And I'm very thrilled that she's applied and accepted that position. And lastly, I think I didn't announce this at the last meeting, Mr. Bailey, William Bailey, raise your hand, is our permanent director of capital improvements. So that is our senior staff, sans one permanent position, which is the Family and Community Partnerships Director, which is in the recruiting stage at this point. And Michelle Hassan, did I announce that last time? Michelle Hassan is our permanent Section 8 Director as well.
All right.
Excellent.
Okay. And that concludes my report.
Okay, well, thank you, Eric, and congratulations to all on the promotions. It's always wonderful to see people in an organization moving up and good things happening. Okay, so moving on to the next item, do we have any reports from commission committees?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think we do. Okay. So no reports from commission committee, so moving to announcements by commissioners, and I think Ms. Bird has one.
The education committee meeting will be meeting this Wednesday, okay? And I have an announcement. I've been reappointed to the NARA Legislative Network, and I just got the appointment last week. Oh, yeah. I'm back on the ledge.
National NARO.
The National NARO.
All right. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Any other announcements? All right, then. Looks like moving right along, we have adjournment. Do we have a motion to adjourn
so
the closed session?
Second.
Okay. So there it is. We shall now adjourn and move to closed session. We'll take 5 minutes or so to take a break.
Ah.